Well, this is the last in this particular, on this particular subject. And as you will recall in our previous talks, we've considered the process of evolution from the coming into being of the Earth about 5,000 million years ago. The evolution of organic matter, you know, life from inorganic matter, which took place much earlier than was at first thought. In fact, about 3,000 million years ago. Now, over the last 30 to 40 years, there has been a lot of speculation by scientists and science fiction writers about the possibility of the existence of life in other parts of the universe. And this speculation is based on what I call the theory of mathematical probability. Because it's argued that the basic elements for the evolution of life exists all over the universe. And because of the millions of star and planet systems which are present, the probability is that life exists on thousands, if not millions, of planets in solar systems similar to ours. You know, the argument is based upon the mathematics that the larger the number, the more likelihood is there to be this phenomena. Now, I find myself in total disagreement with these assumptions, and what I'm going to say now is not necessarily held by the party. It makes no difference whatever to our case, but as far as I'm concerned, I find myself in total disagreement with these assumptions. First, may I say that because the basic elements for the evolution of life are inherent in organic matter, rather, I should say, in inorganic matter, which is, of course, all over the universe, it doesn't necessarily follow that, therefore, life has got to evolve. There has to be a combination of factors, a very unique combination of factors to make this possible. As far as the planet Earth is concerned, there is no evidence to suggest that the development has occurred more than once in the whole time of its existence. But there is a good deal of evidence to show that it will never occur again in the further history of the planet. Now, at this point, I want to give you a description of what a protein is. And I do this, you'll see the significance of this later on. Now, proteins are chemical compounds which are produced by living organisms. They are large chain-like molecules built up of small subunits called amino acids, of which there are 20 different sorts. Natural protein molecules may contain any combination of these units linked end to end. The resulting protein chain, which may be of any length, is folded into a complicated three-dimensional pattern, which is specific for each protein. Because each link in the protein chain may be any one of the 20 different amino acids, the variety of possible proteins is inconceivably large. A protein molecule 100 links long, which is a typical size for a natural protein, could have 20 to the power of 100 possible configurations. And this is a number far larger than the total number of atoms in the universe. Now, don't ask me how the total number of atoms in the universe is assessed. That is in the field of mathematical metaphysics, which I know very little about. But nevertheless, that's what the claim is. Now, bearing this fact in mind, if it is a fact, I take the view that the probability of the enormous number of factors coming together required for the unique, and one could say fortuitous, evolution of organic life is of a magnitude far greater than this. The immense probability is, therefore, that life exists in no part of the universe other than the Earth. So those people who entertain the dream that someday a super intelligence will materialize from outer space to solve mankind's problems are doomed, in my view, to eternal disappointment. And that, as I said earlier, is a private, is my own personal view, and it's nothing really to do for or against the party case. The party case doesn't rest on it. It's just that I consider that's worth saying. Now, the title, as you know, of the talk this evening is Human Nature a Barrier to the Introduction and Operation of Socialism? And before we can come to any conclusion about this, we must first define what we mean by human nature. And many are the times that we are confronted, when we are speaking outdoors or speaking anywhere for that matter, we are confronted with people who assert that socialism is impossible because of human nature. What they are referring to, however, is human behaviour, which, to put it more correctly, should be described as the behaviour of human beings. And that is not just a bit of word juggling or logic chopping. That has a significance which is the same kind of significance as Marx's insistence upon a separation between labour and labour power. It's the same kind of thing, and I'll explain why I've put it that way. And of course, most people are talking about human behaviour of one kind, the behaviour which manifests aggression, greed, cruelty, killing, and all the rest of it. To these people, human nature and human behaviour are one and the same thing. And this is not the case, in my view. The nature of an individual organism, an individual animal for existence, for example, is determined by the sum total of its basic biological attributes, which are about the same for all other members of the species to which it belongs. And of course, this is different from species to species. These biological characteristics are therefore the factors which impose behavioural limitations on all of the members of a particular species, irrespective of individual variations. For example, elephant nature determines elephant behaviour. It is, of course, quite true that human beings can teach elephants to do certain circus tricks, which they would not perform in the wild state, like stepping onto pedestals and standing up on their hind legs and so on. But no human being will ever be able to teach an elephant to speak a language for the simple reason that elephants have no biological equipment for such an accomplishment, so that any great variation of further development of the behaviour of elephants is very limited. And this kind of factor applies to all other animals to a greater or lesser degree, with the exception of Homo sapiens. And the further down the biological scale we go, the more stereotyped does behaviour become. Homo sapiens, on the other hand, has evolved a unique combination of biological attributes, which is the basis for the further development of the human condition. And this combination of biological factors, taken as a single whole, is in fact the nature of the species, or human nature. It is this particular kind of animal nature, the nature of the human animal, which has enabled mankind to develop culture, to be not just a social animal, but to be the social animal above all others. Able to make tools and communicate ideas by speech and language. Now, at this point, I want to diverge somewhat. You will recall that earlier on, when we considered the history of the primates and the emergence of the hominid line, we considered in general terms the role in the evolutionary process of the fossil Australopithecine, Australopithecus, or the southern ape, which, as you recall, or should recall, was first discovered by Professor Raymond Dart in 1925. Now, I want to deal with this a little more specifically because since that time, 1925, the discoveries of hominid remains in Africa has exceeded all previous expectations and is of outstanding importance to a correct understanding of human evolution. All of the East African early hominid and early mankind localities are found in the floor or the sides of the Rift Valley, which extends from Tanzania and continues north, dividing the high plateau country of Kenya and Ethiopia. Now, I did have a map of this, but the photocopying machine at head office is so poor that I'm not going to bother showing you it. But this area, which is a unique area for the study of hominid remains, it's Kenya, Ethiopia, and it stretches right to Ethiopia before reaching the Red Sea near the Gulf of Aden. And there are sites at Olduvia Gorge, which is on the edge of the Serengeti Plain in Tanzania, and you've probably heard about that in relation to the Leakeys, Louis Leakey, Mary Leakey, Meave and Richard Leakey, and all of the other anthropologists that have been working there. And the principal anthropologists, as I said, were involved, the Leakeys. Incidentally, Louis Leakey died in October 1972. And there is another site at a place called Kubifora, which is on Lake Turkana in Kenya, right on the borders of Ethiopia. And another site in Ethiopia, the Haidar, and again, the principal anthropologists were the Leakeys, plus quite a number of other anthropologists from all over the world. Incidentally, Richard Leakey is the director of the National Museums of Kenya. Now, lots of discoveries have been made, but of special notice is the work of Dr. Don Johansson of Cleveland Museum, Ohio, USA, and Owen Lovejoy of Kent State University. These scientists are well versed in what is known as biomechanics. Now, biomechanics is a science based upon paleontology, whereby studying the formation of the bones and so on, calculations can be made as to what kind of mechanical action the particular owner of the bones, when it was alive, performed. Now, after a lot of consideration, Johansson and his colleagues came to the conclusion that the earliest species yet belonging to the family of mankind was that which they named Australopithecus afarensis. And as far as some of the other anthropologists are concerned, they would suggest that afarensis was a kind of a hang-on of Ramapithecus. You'll remember that Ramapithecus was the hominid preceding Australopithecus, about 15 million years ago. Now, they claim that this Australopithecus afarensis, which was the immediate ancestor of the other hominids, which I'll explain later, and this diverged as recently as 5 to 6 million years ago, which would seem to refute the traditional view that the human line diverged from the ape line as long ago as 15 to 20 million years, and that would be in the Miocene. Now, this species, A. afarensis, stood fully erect and walked like modern man, yet had a small brain no larger than a chimpanzee. Now, from afarensis, hominids diverged and evolved in different directions. One to Homo habilis, which is listed in the Nairobi Museum as specimen 1470, and this is dated to a little over 2 million years, shows substantial expansion in the brain case. In other words, Homo habilis was a hominid standing upright, but had a larger brain than afarensis. And this hominid is considered to be the immediate precursor of Homo erectus. Now, you will recall that Homo erectus was the hominid which was in the direct ancestor of Homo sapiens and Homo sapiens neanderthalensis. The other hominid line resulted in a hominid called Australopithecus boisei or robustus. Now, all of these subsequently became extinct, leaving Homo erectus as the sole surviving hominid. Consequently, this evidence suggests that bipedalism preceded the expansion of the brain. This unique accomplishment was the basis for life on the savannah being territory which had open ranges of tall grass and a few trees, as distinct from forest conditions, so that hominids could range more widely over terrain with hands free. Food and raw materials could be transported back to the campsites for tool making and tool using, and manipulative skills could be achieved. And it goes without saying, of course, that the adaptation or the adaptive evolution of the limbs and arms, probably with the prehensile hands from which was previously feet and legs, also took place. So that, you see, from having animals based upon four legs, you got this evolutionary development of what were previously legs becoming arms. Now, at this point, I want to draw your attention to the question of speech and language, because there's a lot of nonsense talked about speech and language and the possibility of monkeys and apes and all sorts of people, all sorts of rather animals being taught to speak. It's quite a lot of nonsense. However, to give you an example, for 6 years, two scientists, Keith and Kathy Hayes, two Americans, tried patiently to teach a chimpanzee called Vicky, a female chimpanzee, to talk. During that time, she never learned to utter more than four words, which were mama, papa, up, and cup. Now, without going into any details, the reason is that monkeys, as well as all other animals, do not have biological equipment for such an achievement. With mankind, the possibility of the use and manufacture of tools depends upon binocular vision, already developed by the climbing monkeys and lemurs, and later on can be added colour vision and the upright posture, setting the arms completely free. And to this must be added The delicate sense of touch, for which the fingers and the fingers' ends have specially developed. In this sense of touch, man far exceeds the sensitivity of any other animal, and the brain has enlarged in front of the central groove the broad belt of the cortex associated with muscular action. And this appears to be associated with anticipation, planning, and the centers concerned with the coordination of the eyes and the articulation of words. The jaws are no longer used to hold things with or to fight with. And the huge, long protuberances on the skull for the once powerful muscles disappear, and the mouth becomes flexible enough to speak with. Associated with this is an important and necessary drop in the position of the larynx. During human evolution, in all mammals prior to mankind, the opening of the larynx normally lies in the soft palate, in the position of rest in the cavity of the nose. Now, this allows the animal to breathe while swallowing, but it effectively prevents any elaborate vocalization. The same anatomical situation is present in a newborn baby, for example, which, of course, is of obvious advantage. Speech, however, becomes possible in the child only when the larynx drops to below the level of the cavity of the mouth. Sound waves set in motion by the vocal cords can then be manipulated within the mouth cavity to produce the great variety of sounds associated with speech. Now, along with that, of course, there are certain areas in the brain. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about neurology, but there are certain areas in the brain that are essential also for the development of conceptual thought, in particular language. Now, if I may give you a quote in relation to some extent to this, to put this in some perspective. This quote is from a book entitled Learning and Instinct in Animals by W.H. Thorpe, who is considered to be a world authority in ethology. And he concludes this book with the following. He says this, after, of course, going into a lot of detail about the behavior of animals. Finally, to assume that studies of animal behavior imply any decrease in the stature of man would be a view of the utmost naivete. In the first place, to do so would be to fall into the very error which at the other end of the biological scale blinds us to the ultimate limitations of further microanalysis. Far from being unscientific, it is sound scientific common sense to see that if only because of the existence of science itself, man displays emergent qualities far transcending those of the highest animal. The existence of his high powers of abstract reasoning and his faith of his religious awareness and spiritual life, his appreciation of moral and aesthetic values, his self-conscious discipline of the will to achieve beauty, goodness, and truth, as well as all the other manifestations of his genius that have already emerged, not only confirms this, but suggests that there are also in him vast further potentialities yet to be realized. It goes without saying, of course, that all this stuff about morality and aesthetic values have got no significance for us, but we can't be responsible for what people like Thorpe and others say, but it just gives you an idea of the conclusions of somebody that has spent a lifetime studying animal behavior. Now, having said all that and diverged, I come back to the main script, as it were. Incidentally, I have a drawing here of the skulls of these three hominids, Australopithecus hominids. The photocopy machine was terrible, so I've drawn them up. So if you like to have a pass that round, have a look at that. Now, consequently, the fact that the evolutionary process, as I've tried to illustrate with this in parenthesis, as it were, the fact that the evolutionary process was a reciprocal one, so that the development towards tool-making and social hunting probably helped to develop speech and language, for example, doesn't alter the fact that what has emerged is a set of basic biological attributes common to all existing varieties of mankind, which has not significantly changed, as far as can be ascertained, over the last 40,000 years. Nor, in my view, is it likely to change, if at all, for hundreds of thousands of years to come, providing the species can survive the possibility of nuclear war or other similar disaster. Consequently, it is incorrect, in my view, to say that human nature does not exist. On the contrary, it would be much nearer the truth to say that human behaviour does not exist. We have practical knowledge so far of only two kinds of social behaviour, human behaviour. One, that of the technically simple, generally peaceful and socially harmonious behaviour of people in the hunting and gathering stage of culture, and two, the acquisitive, aggressive and sometimes warlike behaviour over the last 10,000 years, which has resulted in the most appalling intraspecific inhumanity. And it's this kind of behaviour which is erroneously referred to as human nature by the majority of people who are not aware or ignore consideration of the more gentle and simple behaviour of hunting-gathering society. For most people, the behaviour of human beings within the period of civilization is synonymous with human nature. And as far as they're concerned, there can be nothing else. It can be no other. The ethologists and psychologists, in my view, have been barking up the wrong tree, as it were. They've been trying to find a behaviour pattern which can be applied to all individuals and groups of human beings, irrespective of any other factors. Well, they'll never be able to find it because it doesn't exist. There is no such thing as a definitive human behaviour. Human beings change their behaviour by rational processes. And, of course, sometimes by irrational processes, I suppose you could say. Behaviour is not determined genetically, as it is with other animal species. The concept of socialism postulates a behaviour not yet experienced. This new behaviour of humanity will not be consequent upon a change in biological human nature. It doesn't have to change, even if it were possible. With all animal species, natural selection has slowed down to a relatively slow crawl. With mankind, it's come to a dead stop. Now, this is not to say that the mechanism of natural selection will cease. The biochemical processes will continue, mutations will still occur, but they will not be adaptive. Adaptation will proceed on a cultural basis, not upon a biological one. According to many anthropologists and other scientists, many species of animals are on the verge of extinction. But the most endangered species of all is Homo sapiens. Now I'm going to give you a few quotes. I've not given many quotes throughout this series, but I think that it's quite apposite, as it were, to give you these quotes in relation to the way in which anthropologists are looking at things. For example, David Attenborough, you probably, I don't know whether any of you have read the article, but in an article about gorillas, says that the world has been unfair to gorillas. They are not fierce, breast-thumping marauders, but kind and amusing companions, provided the human visitors have been properly introduced. Besides, he says, I see them as symbols of what we are doing to our own habitat. The rainforest is as vital to us as it is to the gorillas. It regulates climate and furnishes oxygen. If it continues to be cut down, used up in the world at the present rate, I see us heading for climatic disaster. He concludes with the following. In the 25 years that I have been wandering round the globe, I have seen the rainforest decimated, particularly in the Far East. Floods, deserts, and land erosion have been one result. And then he says, I give us another 20 years before we make the world uninhabitable. Does that mean that humans and gorillas will meet their end by the year 2000? This was a question that he was asked. And he replied, I am an optimist, he says. In the nick of time, we will come to our senses. Now, that's Richard Attenborough. Now, David Attenborough. Richard is his actor brother. I know more about Richard, of course, than I do about David, as a matter of fact, but still. Now, in the conclusion to a work called The History of the Primates, W. E. Lee Gross Clark says this, if man has gained his intellectual dominance over his fellow creatures by concentrating his evolutionary energies on the development of his brain, it remains to be seen whether he can now maintain his position by contriving a method of living in orderly relations with members of his own species. If he fails to do so, he may yet follow the example of many other groups of animals which have achieved a temporary ascendancy by an exaggerated development of some particular structural mechanism. He may become extinct. Now, I'd like to read you just one more. I think it's very, very well put. It's worth listening to. And that is an extract or extracts from the concluding chapter of Origins by Richard E. Leakey and Roger Lewin. And this is it. Unquestionably, mankind is special, and in many ways, too. In past history, animals became extinct because, for whatever reason, the environment that had previously nurtured their birth turned hostile. Perhaps the climate shifted, or competition from other species became too severe. Humans are the first animals capable of manipulating the global environment to a substantial degree. So, although throughout evolution we have escaped many of the vicissitudes of the natural environment by becoming in some measure independent of it, we now have in our hands the engines of our own destruction. There is now a critical need for a deep awareness that no matter how special we are as an animal, we are still part of the greater balance of nature. Unless we achieve such awareness, the answer to the question of when the human species might disappear will be sooner rather than later. Make no mistake, the human species is capable of gaining a keen awareness of its place in the global domain, and there is absolutely no reason why the world's population cannot operate in sympathy and harmony, and humility too, with the planet on which we are now, we so recently evolved. During that relatively brief span, evolutionary pressures forged a brain capable of profound understanding of matters animate and inanimate. The fruits of intellectual and technological endeavour in this latter quarter of the 20th century give us just an inkling of what the human mind can achieve. The potential is enormous, almost infinite. We can, if we so choose, do virtually anything. Arid lands will become fertile. Terrible diseases will be cured by genetic engineering. Touring other planets will become routine. We may even come to understand how the human mind works. No one with even the merest whiff of imagination would deny these predictions. What is at stake is whether nations can live peaceably with nations and with an understanding and deep respect for the natural world they inhabit, so that one day these and other predictions may be fulfilled. The answer emphatically is yes. We certainly have the intellectual equipment with which to achieve it, and although the cultural spiral propelled successively by the agricultural, industrial, and technological revolutions is now spinning at a dizzying rate, we can clear our heads and measure short-term goals against the perspective of long-term existence. We are a people, and we can strive for one aim. We are one people, and we can strive for one aim, the peaceful and equitable survival of humanity. To have arrived on this earth as a product of a biological accident, only to depart through human arrogance, would be the ultimate irony. Now, I'm not going to argue about some of the flights of fancy or anything like that, but what I am concerned with, what are these people talking about? What does David Attenborough mean when he says, in the nick of time, we'll come to our senses? What does Lee Gross Clark mean in talking about mankind when he says, it remains to be seen whether he, mankind, can now maintain his position by contriving a method of living in orderly relations with members of his own species? And what does Richard Leakey mean when he says, we now have in our hands the engines of our own destruction? Do they suggest that in mankind's evolutionary emergence as a unique biological unit, there lurks some hidden barrier to the possibilities of further human cultural development? Obviously not. Given the fact that human nature equates with the sum total of mankind's biological attributes, as I suggest, what is there in this entity that is inimical to socialism? Because it is socialism that Attenborough, Clark, and Leakey are talking about, although they don't seem to realise it. What then could there possibly be in an accomplished bipedalism and the ability to stand upright, leaving the arms and prehensile hands with opposable thumbs free for the most complicated manipulations, which could prevent socialism? What is there in stereoscopic binocular colour vision of the very highest quality, with a conceptual thinking apparatus of the highest order, which could prevent the establishment of socialism? My answer to both of those rhetorical questions, or for the whole three of them, if it's three, is that there is nothing in that combination of factors which could or would operate against the establishment of socialism. And it's an absurdity to suggest such a possibility. On the contrary, it is just that combination of factors which makes possible further development in cultural behaviour without the necessity for major biological changes. So may I once again emphasise that the biological makeup of Homo sapiens has not changed in any significant degree during the whole period of his existence of about 4,000 to 50,000 years. And you've got to bear in mind that man, or kinds of man, have existed for nearly 5 million years, but his behaviour, which is the, you may say, the second part of his nature, as it were, and which, as I pointed out earlier, is more appropriate to be called his social behaviour, has changed considerably during that time. There is no evidence to suggest that mankind's behaviour is in any significant degree genetically determined by fixed behaviour patterns, or what is referred to as animal instinct. In fact, it is precisely because of mankind's unique combination of biological attributes which makes it possible for mankind's behaviour to be biologically indeterminate and relatively unlimited in development. Mankind's behaviour is predominantly learned behaviour. And because it's learned, it can also be unlearned. Mankind has been learning, unlearning, and relearning new patterns of social behaviour for 40,000 years. There's no reason to suppose that it will be unable to continue this process for millions of years to come, without any great changes taking place in our biological equipment. And this process is cultural evolution, which, in the relatively short time of around 50,000 years, has effected tremendous changes in the world with a rapidity far greater than the whole 3,000 million years of biological evolution. It is therefore my contention that there are no obstacles set by natural selection which can prevent human society from overcoming social problems, the solution for which lies with mankind itself. Now, this contention, of course, rests upon the theory that the emergence of human society is determined by a new process not dependent upon natural selection. It is not human nature which has to change, but human behaviour. Now, I take neither the optimistic or the pessimistic view. The question arises, how is the behaviour of human beings likely to change? Well, I think that the process of cultural change is somewhat like natural selection. Mutations take place, some of which are adaptive. And I'm talking now about natural selection. But it is not just that mutations take place, but the kind of mutations that occur. There must be a link between the direction which evolution has taken and the kind of mutation which occurs, for instance, the evolutionary direction of the early primates, the tree shrews, having adopted a life in the trees. There must be a connection between the already adopted lifestyle and the development of stereoscopic binocular colour vision, which must have happened in stages. This is in contrast, for instance, to the moles, whose evolutionary direction was towards the atrophy of vision, for a life adapted to burrowing underground. The mutations taking place would all be in line towards that end. Some mutations would be adaptive and some would not. So some would be taken up by a process of natural selection and others would just disappear from the genetic setup, as it were. In like manner, I think that cultural evolution proceeds on a somewhat similar lines. Capitalism engenders ideas like mutations directed towards the solution of capitalist problems. And some of these ideas, although similar, are not adaptive and become extinct, as it were. And I'm thinking, of course, of all the attempts to reform capitalism. That's the kind of ideas that are engendered by capitalism, which I think are doomed to failure because they are not in accord with cultural development. They're not realistic approaches, as it were. And I think that the one idea which is adaptive is the idea of socialism. Whether or not that is adopted is a matter, of course, of conjecture and depends a lot upon us as an organisation and those who support the idea. I don't visualise any other alternative. So that's short and sharp. You've got plenty of time for questions.